Do you think we'll ever control the weather, or do we already control it and we don't
know
it?
Well, let me put it this way. Do you remember the, I think, a 1997-98 film with Sean Connery, The Avengers? The British Avengers, not the...
Yes, yes, yes.
That power has already been achieved, my friend, by Sean Connery.
back in the late 90s.
Yeah. And what was it? Ralph Fiennes and Uma Thurman in that?
Mm-hmm.
Quality flick.
That is, like... And I was... Oh, excuse me.
Don't mind me. Woo. Just choking.
Sorry, I'm a stir fry. Ooh, I got a lot of spice there. Woo. Okay. Wow. Okay. Tear ducts are flowing.
Yeah.
But no, I remember, yeah, I just come off watching Batman and Robin for the 5 millionth time.
Also quality flick.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. You can't tell me different.
No words can convince me.
But yeah, no, I'm looking out my window. Bit of a storm ski on the horizon here.
Gloomy state. I don't like it.
It is a gloomy state.
Good night to do this. Good night for a night in.
Yes. Good night for a night in. And I don't know. Back in the day, I always used to enjoy nights in, and usually a night in meant video games.
Yes.
And meant like a video game marathon. And obviously we've talked about video games on here before.
A few times, handful of times.
Yeah, a few times.
Once or twice.
just a scotch just a dab here and there.
Scotch.
But one in particular that I would like to talk about today is the fabled classic Tomb Raider.
Like the OG, or are we going all over the place? We touch on all installments.
Well, I'm mostly going to stick to the OG, but we can certainly
okay
branch off and compare to the more modern ones, and maybe even touch a little bit on the movies too if we want. But I'm going to strictly talk about the original PlayStation run back in the mid to late 90s.
The
PS1 era.
Yeah, like the golden age of PlayStation.
Mm-hmm. Golden age? Would you say that's their golden age? Their PS1 era?
It's one of them. It's one of their golden age.
Well, it's
I don't know. I feel like PlayStation kind of had, you know, Nintendo was probably giving them a run for their money, but there was a solid stronghold by PlayStation in the 90s.
Oh, yeah. I remember that was like the whole, I think that was like a whole reason like the PlayStation came about, no, or something. Like,
yeah,
they
it
wanted
was like,
to make, like Sony approached Nintendo or something to make like a disc or a new console, but then...
They were like in some kind of partnership deal, and then like PlayStation was kind of shady about it. Like they had some like patents that they filed on the back end without telling them or something. I don't remember the whole story of it specifically, but it was something along those lines.
Yeah. And not that Tomb Raider was exclusive to the PlayStation, but that's what I played it on.
Yeah.
But yeah, so we're going to get into that here today. And let me set the scene for you a little bit here. And specifically, I want to focus on, there's a specific quality of these old school games that I think can be used specifically for not just games, but movies and even a novel too. I think it'd be very tricky to pull it off in that way.
Yeah.
But yes, I'm going to talk about specifically the art of silence and sound, because I think that's one thing that a lot of people forget about the original games. And I bring this up because the remasters just came out, the first three games, Tomb Raider 1, 2, and 3.
Yeah, there was a bit of buzz about this.
Yeah, it came out just this past February. So I wanted to maybe touch on, go back down memory road. Is that the memory lane?
There you go.
Is that it? Okay.
I don't know.
But just go back down that and touch on a little bit of these games, what I enjoyed about them, get your insight on it, compare them to the modern ones.
Yeah.
And then see like what we're looking at coming into the future here. So yeah, let me set the scene for you. I think I actually mentioned this story a little bit before when we were talking about Resident Evil.
Yeah, you did, I think.
And, yeah, and well, like I said, on days in, when you had nights in, one of the things meant video game.
Mm-hmm.
And a big thing was always, you know, like back when we had like the Sega Genesis or the original NES or the Super Nintendo and PlayStation 1. Ooh, excuse me, that stir fry is still
kicking
my ass. Got an extra spice, man. Too much of that spice.
Makes everything not so nice.
No, it does not. No, yeah. So one of the big things I remember was, look, having a big TV, you maybe only had one big TV in the house, right? Like flat screen TVs and all this stuff didn't exist. You certainly didn't have a TV in the palm of your hand.
Yeah.
not a real one anyway. I guess you could make believe and do something if you wanted to, but there were, the cell phone was
not size, even thought of really.
Yeah, the cell phone was the size of a brick at this point, if at all. But one of the big things that I always enjoyed, almost like similar to like, oh, hey, let's go out and get ice cream, you know, when you're a kid, was this idea that, oh, do you want to hook up the Sega or the PlayStation to the big TV, to the living room TV?
You've mentioned this a couple times, like how, like for your family, it was like a whole event.
No, it was just a big thing because we kept it in, you know, the bedrooms. I shared a bedroom with my brother back in the day, and the gaming system was on our small TV there. That's where we mostly kept it. And then every once in a while, every blue moon or every, you know, weekend night in, it was like, oh, what if we would ask permission from our parents, like, hey, can we hook it up to the big TV? And sometimes there would always be like a pillow fort added to that sometime, you know, like we would build a tent in the middle of the living room or something.
I was just recently watching the episode of Community where they built a blanket fort.
Yeah.
Let me think of that.
Excuse me while I take a swig of chicken.
A swig of chicken? Is it like, did you blend it?
Yes. No.
Chicken smoothie.
Chicken smoothie.
Sounds like a Charlie Kelly thing.
Cluck clucks all the way down. But yeah, so we would hook it up to the big screen TV, and we're talking a tube TV still. Mm-hmm. And that was a different time, because now, I mean, you can get, I'm looking at a TV screen right now that's way bigger than that one ever was in terms of screen size. Now that
I have four of them in front of me.
Yeah. And I'm not complaining. Like, I definitely enjoy the revolution of the flat screen TV and what happened with it. So much lighter and easier to move. Like the TV we had at the time, holy hell, this thing was a tank.
Yeah. Like, I remember, you know, our neighbor had one of those like wooden, like built wooden like things like that took up like half the room. It was a whole ordeal.
You had that like embossed wood varnished all around to protect the picture tube. Mm-hmm. And it made the thing look so much bigger and heavier than it needed to be. But man, was it
a piece of furniture.
Just like, yeah, it literally was. So yeah, hooking it up, and we had to hook it up. There was a weird way, because that TV at the time didn't have even AV input, like the yellow, red, and white input cables that, you know, you could stick in.
Yeah.
We had to bypass
AV,
it through
AV
the cable
jacks,
cord.
as they're
yes,
known.
Yes, thank
to
you.
The video geek nerd.
I went to college, don't worry. But you had to hook it up by using an adapter through the cable cord, and it would f*** with the cable. And then you had to go to channel 3 to get it to work. That's where you had to go, and you had to hit the button and all that stuff. Well, so finally, you know, the PlayStation comes out, blah, blah, blah. And I can remember, like I said, prefaced it with the Resident Evil. There was a day my brother and I went out to Blockbuster, a video, you know, back when you rented videos in physical form.
Which
things
that was
exist.
A whole different time too. Like the physical grab and go rent stuff.
Yeah, that was an event in and of itself. So not only were we going out on like a weekend, Friday night, not only we had just gotten the PlayStation, I believe, and it was like, all right, we got to test out some new games, and we're going to play it upstairs. And I remember specifically this night, I pick Resident Evil, like I said before. If you would like to know the story behind why I picked that one, go visit the Resident Evil episode.
Yeah, which is, I like that episode. It was a good one.
Yeah, and my brother picks Tomb Raider. I think he had heard about it from a friend at school or something. And we bring them both home, and we just have a marathon. We end up getting a memory card. This was the first time I ever heard of a memory card.
Yeah, like a memory card. They were proprietary. They were proprietary at the time, right? Like they made their own.
Maybe, I'm not sure. It's certainly possible.
Yeah, because like now it's just like everybody gets their whole shtick is get an SD card. Everything runs on those now. And but I'm pretty sure like PlayStation had like their, like you had to buy the PlayStation memory card.
Oh yes, yes, you did have to buy the PlayStation memory card. So yeah, we hook it up. We're upstairs, and lo and behold, now I know by today's standards, the graphics are not good. All right. I'll fully back you on that one.
Well, like, yeah, if you compare it to what's done now, for sure. Like they're all the systems were like bits by comparison of what you can do now. Like, like we had talked about the Last of Us episode, like that graphically pushed systems so far that they had to build new systems to be able to handle it.
Yeah.
A lot of the devs said that like it didn't run properly until they initialized it on a PlayStation 4. Cause like it was like stretching the limits of what a PS3 could do.
I vaguely remember them doing like in one of the, yeah, one of their conventions, like state of play things that they do, mm-hmm. about the progression of the graphics and the computing power from like a PlayStation 1 all the way up to that time, which would have been a PlayStation 4.
Yeah. And they mention it kind of briefly in that Grounded documentary for Last of Us. There's some cool technical stuff in there.
But yeah, this was, so looking at Tomb Raider, we're in late 1996. We're like right before Christmas, actually. Maybe.
Yeah.
Well, for me, this might have been maybe early 97. I don't think it's somewhere in that time.
That was like prime 90s too. Like all like a lot of like things were coming to culmination that had been started in the 90s.
Yeah.
Around like 97, 98.
Well, yeah. And this was the first time I had been exposed to a 3D environmental game. Like,
yeah.
You know, I had so been used to the, and I will say this, the 2D games have aged better than the first generation 3D games.
There's like whole nostalgia thing for like the top downs and side scrollers. Like,
yeah.
Those are like, those, Nintendo just put out a brand new side scroller Mario for like the first time in a long time. So
yeah, those classic platform side scrollers with the arcade design and look and feel and the pixels, those have aged better in terms of graphics, I would say, than these first generation 3D games. But that was because it was such a huge leap. You know, you're literally going into another dimension
into
another dimension. This week on Chopped 0.30. We're going to do some interdimensional cooking with your host. Anyway, cut that out. Sometimes I feel like I have a joke and I just hope I'll come up with something good
to
get to the end. But yeah, but it never happens. Anyway, but yeah, though, this was a big impact in terms of that three-dimensional world. You're adding like another layer of complexity to the just from the physical programming side.
It's like at this time, like the graphics were like very limited by the polygons. There weren't a lot of like rounded edges. Like you had a lot of square heads and stuff, and like the amount of like, I can't find the word.
Oh, I thought you were gonna talk about the square when you said the square head. I thought that's where you were going with it.
I was trying not to. But,
well, no, I mean, but, we could talk about it. I mean, obviously,
I think it's fairly unavoidable. I think
it's a meme. Like, yes, the are very squared in that first game.
Yeah.
They figured it out in the second game. It became very memed.
It was very heavily memed.
Yes. No, I know it's been heavily, but that, yeah, we got it out of the way. But yes, no, this leap into that third dimension and adding that, you felt, for me, playing it for the first time, or well, actually I should say watching someone play it for the first time, and the audio, it was literally, for me, it was going into that next dimension up. And that leap into the third dimension in gaming was literally for me felt like a huge transition in that world building, that envelopment, that immersion, you know, that emotional escape, if you will, which I feel like is the gold standard for any type of creative endeavor. Be it to move your audience in some way, be it, you know, intelligently, emotionally, thoughtfully, whatever you want. And the trick always doing that, I feel like that's the gold standard for any creative endeavor, is to move your audience.
Yeah, absolutely.
Be it emotionally, you know, mentally, thoughtfully, whatever. And
yeah, this, and you want them to connect with them. Like, they have to have some reason to engage with the material. You know, it can't just be like a simple thing. Like, I feel like the best quality things have to have some level of philosophy, some level of character involvement. Mm-hmm. Like, you have to have a reason to be engaged.
Yeah, agreed. And I know this, when I talked a little bit in the beginning about just that art of silence, I think Tomb Raider does that really well. And whether or not that is just out of the limitation of the hardware at the time, which probably it was, because I know programming for the PlayStation was tricky. Again, remember, this is the first 3D at-home console. Or in that era, at least.
It was the first disc-based console, right?
I think it was definitely one of the first. I I know there were a couple, you know, hot on its heels or close by. That was like the big thing, like in the mid to late 90s, was, okay, who's going to have the next big, you know, system shift? You know, who's going to enter the fray? Because up until that point, it was always cartridges or arcades or computers. But what was the next thing? And it was going towards discs. CDs, DVDs came a little bit later than you had. had Blu-rays. The short live of the. Do you remember the HD DVDs?
Yeah, they quickly became proprietary to Microsoft too.
Yeah, yeah.
That was an interesting trend.
Yes, but anyway, I digress. With this, you know, leaping into that third dimension, I thought what was interesting, and too, I remember like there's a really good little short, not short, maybe like 20-30 minute video online. I forget the name, but it's the creator of the original Crash Bandicoot.
Oh, okay.
Taking cool. you through how the PlayStation worked, its hardware, and some of the tricks they used to get the full benefit out of it.
Yeah.
And they actually use, and I will say, if you go look at the original Crash Bandicoot game and compare it to the original Tomb Raider, the graphics are much, you can see that they did something different and really got the full power out of it. But because of that limitation, and the original Tomb Raider was developed by a Core Design, a British company, I believe, and then released by Eidos, and or vice versa. I think I have that right.
Yeah, you're more up on that one than I am.
And you know, it was centered around this, you know, female lead, which was a big thing too.
Yeah, she kind of quickly became the female Batman in a lot of ways.
Yeah, you had this sort of definitely an Indiana Jones female character with a bit of a James Bond edge and lifestyle to her. You know, she's an aristocrat, comes from a long line of Crofts, and you know, she got a manor, she's British, and she's just going around robbing tombs. She's tomb raiding. So what was so interesting to me, this game, when I remember first watching it, was, again, it could just be the limitation of the sound design or what, you know, they didn't quite know what they had yet in terms of the system. Because remember, it's kind of, there was a lot of growing pains in this era looking back.
Yeah.
In terms, I think, for developers and how to like, okay, how do I program this whole new addition? You know, it's like when you get like a twist thrown at you in the middle of a challenge. So because of that, you know, there were definitely some short givings, I'm sure, compared to the like orchestral symphonies that we get in games today. Like, I mean, the sound, you mentioned The Last of Us before. I mean, the sound in that alone and the score, I mean, is so just.
Gustavo Santaolalla did such a crazy good job with that score. It's nuts.
I mean, yeah, I couldn't like without, I mean, I feel like that speaks to the heart of the whole story of that game. So when looking at the original Tomb Raider, if you go back and, you know, you look at the polygon nature of it, to their benefit, whether they knew it or not, and especially too, at that time, I had nothing else to compare it to. I had never seen anything like this before. The lack of background noise or that sort of orchestral noise, like orchestral sound, you know, really like Hollywood style cinematic quality of music.
Yeah.
You felt it worked for this game and its gameplay. Sorry, the bug flew at me. Like, you shut your mouth right now. But yeah, it really that use of silence, intentional or not, I
it's not very common.
What's that? No, it's not very common.
Everyone tries to fill those spaces.
Yeah, everyone wants to fill that with some sort of sound or noise or something, even if it's not warranted. I think this goes back to what I've said before. You know, look at the ludonarrative dissonance episode. You want to make sure that those pieces are all there. And sometimes the pieces, you don't even know they're necessarily there until you have like that happy accident.
But
a lot of people will add, what's the term we learned in school? Like the background, like walla, was that the term that we used? Or am I getting that wrong? For like some of the background noise that you would add?
For sure. That sounds right, but I'm not 100% sure.
Yeah, but anyway, well, like, you know how you would add, walla. Like the Foley artists would add like the background noises and stuff. In this, you truly do feel that atmosphere of being alone in a tomb by yourself. Like, I'm like, I feel like this is probably the closest thing I could get to in terms of the sensory, the audible of what it would be like to be alone in a cave exploring, you know, the first level, the ancient, like you're in like these ancient Peruvian caves looking for a lost Incan civilization. And I feel like that's probably as close as I'm ever going to get to that, to actually, short of actually going to the Andes Mountains and finding a cave and finding a lost Incan civilization, which I don't think I'm going to be doing anytime soon.
Or if you watch the movie Madame Web.
Madame Web, wait.
Because they do that. It's like the whole beginning with her mom.
Okay. I gotcha. Yes.
Yeah.
I have not seen Madam Web.
Oh, I just spoiled it for you then. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, Brian. No, it's okay.
We're in the best movie of the year.
But yeah, looking at that, you know, you have there's literally most of the noises. I would say if I had to put this in a more professional manner, you know, rather than me just rambling, you have, this is almost a 100% all the noises are diegetic.
Yeah.
In the original game. Yes, it does have some couple stingers of like noise and like, you know, you have the original soundtrack on the menu screen. And when the music does come in, that's what I love about this. And again, I'll say this, I am 100% biased. This is one of my top 10. Yeah, this is one of my favorites. So it definitely holds a special place. So if you just think I'm full of absolute I don't care, but fine, whatever. But I'm just going to go on my little rant here about this. One of the things I love, and I'm specifically going to focus a lot more on the sound design of, because, you know, they did what they could with what they had. And even though at the time it was cutting edge compared to today, it's, you know, it's primitive in the technology we have now, which is strange to think because wasn't that long ago.
Yeah.
What I think is amazing is a lot of the noises, the sound design is strictly, I'd say, 85 to 90% diegetic noise, meaning the noises are coming from the environment or the character moving. You know, it's nothing more than the thump thump of her walking.
If it isn't happening in the scene, it's not creating sound.
Yeah. There's not something outside the world of the game causing the noise. Like music is non-diegetic. I think we've talked about this before, diegetic and non-diegetic sounds.
A little bit, yeah. I don't know if we've like dedicated a moment to discussing
So essentially just to catch everyone up on that. Diegetic, I don't know where the term of like the actual physical definition of the term, but when referring to filmmaking, a diegetic noise is something that emanates from something in the world of the story, a gunshot, a door slamming, car, traffic, something that, you know, the character's interacting with. You can have diegetic music if it's coming out of a radio, someone's listening to something on their cell phone, like, you know, some people can blur the line like that.
Like where, if it's happening to the characters, like
yeah. And then non-diegetic is something that is not emanating from anything in the actual world for the character, the world of the story, like some of John Williams' great scores, you know, Indiana Jones, Jurassic Park, Harry Potter, E.T. When those things start playing, the characters are not hearing that, and it's not coming from anything in the world.
Did you ever see the Aeronauts on YouTube? They have done
I know what you're talking about. Yes,
a couple times they've taken scenes and like removed the orchestral score and shown just like kind of how awkward they play out, because like without the music, like the world, like the situation doesn't feel quite as awe-inspiring. So yeah, it's just kind of funny.
No, it doesn't. It does not. And I think that's what I think I love so much about the original Tomb Raiders, especially the first one, because when you go, I think the second, when you go into the second and the third one, the original three games, they got better. The technology improved a little bit more, so they were able to do more with the sounds, and they were able to add more, you know, cinematic like music to it. But it's still, I'd say the original three still kept the core, no pun intended, of the first game. And one of the things I love about it is that deliberate use of, okay, we can't put a lot of that just sweeping score into it, you know? And that was one thing, I don't know, did you ever notice back in school, like how, like, damn, how hard it was when it came to like putting music to your short films or something? Yeah.
Well, that was the one thing that was lacking. There was no music department.
Yeah. And it was just like, you would shoot it. You'd be like, oh yeah, you'd have that idea. Your imagination would just be going wild and you'd be like, oh yeah, okay. And then you're like, oh, I don't have any music. What do I do? And it took me a while to think of this. It's like, okay, rather than trying to work with what I had at the time, which was more access to diegetic elements, like, you know, even if it's something that's added in later as Foley, like a Foley noise, rather than trying to, you know, call up Hans Zimmer and say, hey, Hans, Bubby, I need you to write me a 15-minute score here on this story I wrote. He's like, who the hell are you? Well, you don't know me yet, but I'm going to be somebody someday 20 years later. But I think what I would have, if I could go back and redo it, I would have focused more on, okay, how can I use what I have sound design wise. I would have given more time to sound design too.
Same. I think like we talked, especially in that episode with Christina, like sound is incredibly overlooked a lot of the time, and when it is, it's more noticeable than if you overlook camera.
And I do think that's that's something I would definitely encourage people, if you want to do a short film or work in like, I don't know how it would work in gaming in terms of like the actual programming, but still the design of paying attention to sound as very
sound design in gaming is very fascinating for how it's coded.
Yeah.
Even music, like how music can repeat, like the way they code mm-hmm. certain tracks and stuff. There's yeah. a lot of really interesting stuff there.
Yeah. And with the original Tomb Raider, looking back on it now and having played through some of the remaster that they came out with, I just, that use of saying, okay, we only have really in our arsenal sound wise is the diegetic noises. We can get the footsteps, we can get the gunshots, we can get the ambiance of the caves or the ruins, the dust floating across the rocks, the water hitting the shore, the water, you know, dripping down onto the ground. We have to rely on that in terms of the sound. And I think yeah. that's what they understood when they were doing this. And they were like, we have a limited number of times, whether it was through technology, they just couldn't do it at the time. They didn't have, maybe the team wasn't big enough, budget wasn't big enough. I mean, credit, this was the first game. It wasn't a household name yet. You know, Lara Croft was not a known entity in 1996. This was yeah. brand new. So if you're a designer,
what do you mean you've seen this? This is brand new.
This is what do you mean you've played this? It's brand new.
Brand new.
Well, yeah, you know, we have two of them. Can't have two TVs. But yeah, I thought about that before, and I was saying basically you only had maybe one big TV in the house, and every other TV, yeah. if you had another one, was like the smaller ones, like the size of a laptop screen. I think even laptop yeah. screens are sometimes bigger.
Yeah, look, a lot of the time, like it's comparable to like an iPad. Like was yeah. like in our house anyway. Like the TVs that we had were like small. They weren't yeah. crazy.
So for me, a lot where the true, I think, masterpiece of Tomb Raider lies is, I know a lot of people get on the graphics, the old graphics and the square. Yes. And they didn't, like, she has a ponytail, but in the first game they couldn't, again, maybe because they just didn't have enough people to devote, you know, time to do it, because in the second game they finally give her a ponytail, because yeah. in the full rendered cutscenes she has it, but in the gameplay it's almost like she has it like tucked underneath or something.
Yeah. Just like glued to her back.
Yeah. Or yeah. Who knows what happened to it. So in the second game, after they made tons of money on the first one, they were able to dedicate more time to refining and fixing it.
Yeah.
But they knew that, okay, I only have, I think if you go back through and play, there's 15, there's maybe only, don't quote me on this, I did not do the research, I'm just going through my...
You didn't do your research?
I didn't do your research? I never do my research.
What do you think this is?
You think I'm freaking working over here. I would say they almost knew, okay, we can only maybe fit 30 tracks that equal about 20 seconds each,
yeah,
you know, onto this CD, into this file for people to play. So we have very limited in terms of of actual physical non-diegetic score to work with. So we have to use it in the right places. A lot of them are used, I would say, for like a stinger, like, you know, you see in like horror movies a lot, you know, like the jump scare.
Yeah.
You know, something darts out of one area and there comes the music and it ramps you up. And they did that well, I think, in using the lack of that ability to have so much orchestral noise. They had to rely strictly on the diegetic sound and making you feel like when you're playing this game, you are in that tomb with her. It's just you and the game, nothing else. I know it doesn't have the cinematic style of the more modern ones, but there is something meditative about the original Tomb Raider game that I think I just personally love. And I think for me, if I had to pinpoint it, it's the sound design of it. The gameplay too, don't get me wrong, like that is huge. The puzzle box nature. It's a puzzle yeah. game first, and you just happen to have some action bits in it. Whereas I think the modern games, and they are great games in their own right, but the difference is they rely more on the cinematic action than that sense of exploration. In the original games, I felt like, and two, you didn't have that. There was no tutorial really. I take that back. There is a tutorial level. You can go to her
now
home.
Now there is.
You can go to her home and learn some of the things, but you can do all that's optional. You can go straight into the game. A lot of games now, they'll have like, okay, this is the tutorial section, because rightfully so, they've become more complex and they gotta, you know, wean you into it. They gotta make that learning curve a little bit easier. Otherwise, you might put the game down too quickly and they're not gonna make money. But back in the mid to late 90s, it was just your only really hope was to read the instruction booklet, and then the rest of it was just, here it is, go. Just figure yeah. it out. And that to me is something that's, it emphasizes the role of the player over the role of the spectacle these old games do. And for me, that sound design, I think, is key. Because if I go back, I almost would say this would be a funny like little experiment to do. Like if someone, maybe there is something out there, but if someone like took the original games and just added, you know, worthless music, not worthless music, but worthless
but like,
in the sense
like
of like
not clearly not like hard invested.
Yeah, like not to be there. And just to see like what, how would it feel? I feel like for me, it would be like, I'd be like, no, give me the quieter version. It's a quiet game, I'd say, in compared to other, to, not only just other PlayStation games of its era, but even modern games today.
Yeah.
But so the sounds and the noises that you feel, that you hear, they ring. You actually feel them. I believe.
Because like you said, it was like every note that was put on there was sacred space on that desk.
Yes.
Like it
no,
was,
yeah,
it was
exactly.
A very
no, that's
conscious
perfect
choice.
Way to put it. Yeah, it was sacred space. They were like, okay, there was like, you know, it's like doing poetry. You only have so many words to work with.
I thought you were gonna give me the George Lucas, like it rhymes.
No,
poetry, it rhymes.
No, it's poetry. They rhyme. No, I'm saying in poetry, in the sense of, you know, you have a limited space, a limited canvas, limited number of words to work with. So you have to be very particular in what you're going to do, how it's going to look, how it's going to sound. And so that use of noise, of sound in the original Tomb Raider games, I think just is what makes it for me. And then when you get through a level and, you know, the cutscene kicks in and the music finally kicks in or something, it feels that much sweeter. You know, we talk about when you're writing a story, the main character, you want their, if they're going to triumph in the end, you want that to feel earned. You want that bittersweet, that just, that panache. Is that the word I'm looking for?
Yeah. I'm a big believer that like in any creative medium, the more restrictions you take away, the generally worse off the product can end up sometimes.
Yeah.
Because it seems like a lot of the times when you see these great pieces of creativity, it's like you always hear about the adversity that the creators overcame to get it made and like all the obstacles that they fought their way through. And I feel like there's a lot less of that now because there aren't as many walls. You can do so many things now that you couldn't before. And it's just, it's an interesting twist that, you know, the more capabilities we have, it seems like the less we're able to accomplish in a lot of ways.
No, yeah. And that's what I think I like about these games. Like it makes those moments when you beat the level that much sweeter because it feels earned in the game design. The controls, I know everyone thinks they're clunky. That's those tank controls. I've never had issue with them, honestly. Yeah. Like I get it, whatever. But for me, the sound and the nature of the sandbox style of like, I'm just going to drop you in this area. I'm not going to really give you any hints or anything. And it's just go ahead and try and
it's up to you to literally solve the puzzle.
Yeah. And, you know, looking back on it, it definitely is one of the few games that I can think of that does that. And the emphasis on like, you know, the less is more we've talked about before, but I think you put it perfectly
in a lot of ways.
Like,
yeah.
Have when you take away more restrictions, it can
have an adverse effect.
Yeah,
actually.
Yeah. It can have the inverse effect to it. You like you think it'll make it better, but because there's no adversity to putting out what you want, your creative product, sometimes it can
feel less earned by those creating it. Even
yeah,
you know.
Yeah. No. Definitely. I look at like some of the levels. There's something about standing in this, you know, artificial world, and it's completely empty, devoid, and there's no other like human characters too. I mean, I shouldn't say no other. There's a few, but most
like strangely few.
Yeah, strangely few in the first game. Most of it is just animals or nature and some weird creatures here and there. But you certainly feel like you've stumbled upon a lost civilization, and that I think is key to think about anything when you do your work. Is okay. What do I have to work with here? What is the restrictions, or you know? And obviously, depending on the medium you're working in, the restrictions will change and be different, but I think still there always are. It's like you want to write a book and you're not a known name author, but you want to keep it, if it's your first novel, you're trying to get it out there, you want to keep it within the, depending on the genre, the 50,000 to 90,000 word range, depending on like what you think you're going to write. And that is, I think that shows too, is that, okay, not only, I think this is something I struggle with too, is like if you'd like to be more creative, that production side of it, the producer, you know, who's like, all right, guys, we have a deadline. We got to get this shot, or it's like, no, we can't. We don't
have
the money.
It's that pressure.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's the pressure cooker that makes the greatness.
Yeah, that right brain, left brain combo working in tandem. Yeah. And I think the original Tomb Raider is a good example of that when it comes to, well, this is what we had to work with.
We had mentioned too, I think part of the charm, and I think that this launched even kind of like a subgenre of games, was mm-hmm. that otherworldly aspect, like that adventure. Like you feel that you've discovered this lost civilization world. I feel like games like Uncharted and several others like that, like have scratched at that, but this like kicked the door in to that whole atmosphere.
Oh,
it's
absolutely.
Like you kind of feel like you walked into Raiders of the Lost Ark, and that's worth its weight in gold. Like,
oh,
right
yeah.
there.
No, 100%. Yeah. Well said. Yeah. And because it was one of the first ones for me that added that third dimension, you needed the sound design to step up. But what I tip my hat to is like, how does the sound design step up when they're also limited to, when you think about it, as to like, okay, this can hold a lot of memory for what we were used to back then, but it still has its limitations. And it's like, okay, what are we going to use here, and how are we going to do it well? And I think, you know, I'm hitting the same note home here, but the sound design in this, I think, is what really, really makes it.
Well, yeah, it's like each piece has its one thing that shines through. And I think when it's something that does really drive home how a technical aspect can work and why a certain philosophy in a creative work just makes things click together, it's like,
mm-hmm.
it sells the world. And that's not an easy thing to do.
No.
Especially, I think it's even harder in video games comparatively to like
I would agree,
film or TV shows, what have you. So when something like that does click, and it is a very different philosophy from the way certain things or other things have done, I think it can be jarringly grabbing that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think that that's a good thing and a testament to the people who are willing to do things a little differently than, you know, the norm.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you compare the originals to the newer modern, I think they're updating it again. They're going to come out with something new, or there's going to be a Tomb Raider show or something. I don't know.
I've heard rumors about that. The rights have floated in and out of a couple of different areas. I think it's Sony that has it now, if I'm not mistaken, if it's not mm-hmm. bouncing to Amazon or somebody like that.
Yeah, but yeah.
Yeah, so it'll be interesting to see where that goes. I think, you know, you had mentioned briefly touching on the movies. I think that the Angelina Jolie run had great successes. You know, obviously it's flaws, but I think that it was nicely dovetailed by the Alicia Vikander ones. Like mm-hmm. everything that one got wrong, the Angelina Jolie ones got right.
Yeah.
Vice versa.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, you know, I think that's one thing I'd be interested to see if someone could pull it off in terms of, if you turned it into a movie, is look at the sound design of the original games and be like, okay, how do I mimic that? Because here's something just simple to do, if you have the ability, you just go on YouTube, look at the original first level of the first game. It's called Caves. That's the name of the first level.
Yeah.
Play it. I would recommend you to actually play it, because I feel like you'll get a better thing. But if you don't can't, just watch something online of it. And then go and play the one that sticks in my mind, is from Rise of the Tomb Raider, the second of the newest trilogy, and play the first level in that. And just, there's a stark contrast in terms of the sound, because in the second one, again, it's not fair to compare two very vastly different generations of gaming, but in that second version, you have just, I feel like I get, one of the things I didn't like about it was I'm being bombarded constantly by just not only like diegetic noise. I think if I remember correctly, there's like a chopper following you and it's firing left and right into a cave, and there's the soundtrack is just blaring, and I'm like, oh, whoa. Maybe I'm just getting old, but for me, Tomb Raider was more of a cerebral interpersonal game, in terms of, just like I said, just you and the game and trying to get past it. That was it. There was a simplicity to it.
Yeah, and it's that puzzle aspect. I'm a big fan of like puzzle style game, like situationally puzzle style games, and this is definitely a big one.
It is the equivalent of a jigsaw puzzle. Like, you just want to have quiet, like, you know, put together a puzzle on your desk somewhere at home. That, I'd say the original Tomb Raiders, especially the first one, is the equivalent to that.
Yeah.
It's a cousin.
Uncharted kind of grabbed that pretty well too. Like they got that idea, and that's what makes it.
But no, I mean, the, you know, Tomb Raider, it's been around for a while now. Definitely Lara Croft is a household name. Definitely iconic. A character that's entered our lexicon of characters, like, you know, how like a Superman is or something along those lines, or Indiana Jones.
Or Batman,
whatever, you know, pick who you want. But yeah, I think looking looking back at these original games, that sense of knowing what you want to put out and working within what you have, and it created a phenomenal use of sound, I think.
And it launched such a franchise of games too.
Yeah,
this like blew open the door for PlayStation. Like,
oh yeah, absolutely.
Genre games were going to be the thing, and they definitely took note of that.
Yeah,
and I feel like especially as like Microsoft got off to their start during the PS2 era, like they definitely emulated that model. Like they were going after genres as their big heavy hitter originals.
Yeah, and these games are not easy in their own right. Like, I mean, if you really want, just to play through them is tough, the original ones. And I do encourage, like, especially the remaster. They've done a good job of polishing up the, you know, still keeping that the essence of the original games. And you can switch back and forth, which I really like. You can easily just click a button. Yeah. You can see what it looked like originally, and then you can tap on the HD, you know, revitalized graphics if you want. But they did a good job.
Which isn't an easy process in its own right. I mean, I know a lot of games have not been very successfully remastered.
Yeah.
And hearing some bad things about the Battlefront series that just came out. And a few other things. So it's, when one does click into place and they do it justice, it's a big credit to the people involved.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. They did a good job of like a loving restoration, I think I would give this. But yeah, if you can, I recommend, if you have the time and you need to, you're going to make it a night in with Tomb Raider. Grab the remaster, play it around, you know, and just sit there with the game. Put the phone away and just sit there for and play that game. You know, I think that too is what it reminds me of, is a time when you could still unplug at the time when this came out, you know?
Yeah.
There
was not as much to unplug from.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, compared to today. And I think that's why I enjoy these, because they demand your focus and attention too, with the way the game doesn't spoon feed you like where to go next. You kind of have
challenges to, you. It forces you to think a little differently. Yeah. I love puzzle systems like that.
Like, yeah. Like I said, it's
challenged.
It's that jigsaw puzzle equivalent.
But
they are tough games. And I know a lot of people try to do no save, no loads, no meds runs, where they basically play the whole game through without ever healing or saving the game.
It's nuts.
So like a permadeath run, essentially. Like if you die once, you got to go all the way back to the beginning and start again. People have done it.
A couple of games like built that into their difficulty systems too after a while.
Yeah. But yes, no, I give it a shot.
I agree. It's a good one. And one for the books.
Yeah. With your host. Anyway. cut that out.